Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you very much for having me here as part of the Sydney Ideas Public Lecture Series. It's a fantastic program, and I'm honored to be a part of it. And thank you for being here tonight. I'd also particularly like to thank Colm Harmon and Russell Toth and Vanessa Holcomb for all their work bringing me here and organizing my stay, which has been absolutely fantastic, both as from an academic point of view and a personal point of view. So what I wanted to talk about today is the extent to which addictive behaviors respond to incentives. And so the title, Reefer Madness, Frank the Tank, or Pretty Woman, is illustrative of three different ways that through history we have viewed addictive and habitual behaviors. And I'll elaborate on each of those in just a bit. And so what I'll cover tonight is, first of all, just to start out by motivating, you know, why do we care why people engage in habitual and addictive behaviors? Define what I mean by habitual and addictive, and then illustrate those three models of addictive behavior. So the first model of addictive behavior is that people are simply irrational, that when they are consuming alcohol, when they're consuming drugs, they're absolutely unresponsive to incentives, to information, and to prices. And you can illustrate that with the movie Reefer Madness. At the opposite end of the spectrum is the idea that addicts or people engaging in addictive behaviors are perfectly rational, and they do respond to information, they respond to prices, they understand risks. And you can illustrate that with an excerpt from the movie Pretty Woman. And then finally, you can think of there being something really in between, maybe an imperfectly rational model of an addictive behavior. And you can illustrate that with the character Frank the Tank from Old School. So I'll show you each of those clips and explain how it illustrates these ways of viewing habitual and addictive behaviors. And then, of course, we don't just want to think about what different models are out there, but which one is correct. And so I'll talk about what we know from a very vast economic literature that studies the extent to which people respond to incentives even when engaging in these very both emotional and potentially addictive activities. Do they respond to prices? Do they respond to information if you tell them about the health harms of smoking? Do teenagers respond to information about the risks of having unprotected sex? And so on. And then finally, I'll describe why it matters which of these models is correct in terms of helping us formulate public policy. So first, to start out, why do we care about risky health behaviors, and why do we care whether we can modify them? Well, the answer has to do in the very long run with a trend that's been taking place over centuries that's known as the epidemiologic transition. And so what the epidemiologic transition describes is the fact that over the past, you know, several hundred years, we've moved from a world in which people died young from infectious disease to a world now where people die at a relatively old age from the decisions that they make. Right? So you can illustrate that by looking at what were the top three causes of death in Australia in 1907, and what were the top three causes of death in the year 2000. So back in 1907, the top three causes of death were heart disease, tuberculosis, and diarrhea. Right? And so most people today don't even know what tuberculosis is, but in 1907, it was the number two killer in Australia. If you look at 2000, the number one killer is the same, it's heart disease. Number two is stroke, and three is lung cancer. So infectious diseases like tuberculosis, diarrhea are gone. They're way down the list, and instead we have diseases that are associated with living a long time, but also the results of our own risky health behaviors. So some of the fascinating trends that have taken place here in the past 100 years is that there's been a 96% reduction in deaths from infectious disease in Australia over the past 100 years, but a 700% increase in lung cancer deaths among women. So again, we're not dying from infectious disease, we are dying as a result of the decisions that we make about our own health. This has been mirrored in the US, where the top three causes of death 100 years ago were pneumonia and influenza, tuberculosis and diarrhea, and today they're heart disease, cancer, and respiratory disease. And in the year 2000, in the year 2004 and 5, some researchers from the CDC took all the death certificates in the US and then backed out, well, what were the decisions, what were the actual causes of death behind the heart disease, behind the cancer? And what they calculated is the top actual causes of death are use of tobacco, a poor diet and physical inactivity, and alcohol consumption. So that just perfectly illustrates the epidemiologic transition that increasingly we're dying because of our own choices. And if you look worldwide, I've mentioned Australia, I've mentioned the US, worldwide, the World Health Organization calculates that 6 million people die every year from tobacco use. Tobacco use is responsible for 71% of all lung cancer in the world. Insufficient physical activity, sedentary lifestyles, kills another 3.2 million people in the world each year. Alcohol abuse kills another 2.3 million, and overweight and obesity together kill 2.8 million per year. If you want to add together tobacco, alcohol, and drugs, together they're responsible for 12.4% of all deaths worldwide every year. So basically, if we want to continue this wonderful trend that we've experienced over the past several centuries of rising life expectancies and decreasing preventable death, we have to focus on risky health behaviors. We have to find ways of help weaning people off of tobacco smoking, off of binge drinking, off of taking drugs, engaging in risky sex, and so on. But the question is, although we call these modifiable risk factors, are they truly modifiable? Do we have any hope of getting the people who engage in risky sex in Africa to getting them to stop, to use protection? Do we have hope of getting people who are hardcore heroin addicts, of getting them off of drugs? And so that's really the key question that I want to get at today is, what do we know about the extent to which habitual and addictive behaviors respond to information, prices, and so on? So let me back up first a little bit and just say what I mean by addiction. So researchers have tended to characterize something as addictive if it has the following three properties. The first is that you experience withdrawal when you're not taking it. And that's actually not a very discriminating characteristic, because really what withdrawal says is that you're less happy not having it than you are having it. And that's true of chocolate, right? Chocolate makes you happier when you have it than when you don't have it, consume it, I mean. And so withdrawal alone is not a very good way of identifying something as addictive or not. Tolerance is the second characteristic, and specifically what tolerance means is that the amount of this substance that you've consumed in the recent past directly affects your happiness today. And so I'll call this amount that you've had in the recent past the stock of addictive consumption, sort of what's left in your system. And if you're engaged in a harmful addiction, then the amount you've consumed in the recent past lowers your utility. By utility, I just mean happiness, right? So the longer you've been a smoker, the more you've smoked in the past, the worse your health is going to be and the less happy you'll be today. If you're a heroin addict, you're going to be less happy today. So it might seem strange that I'm talking about in a harmful addiction, but there's beneficial addictions too. So you can be addicted to distance running, right? So when you go distance running, you get these release of, neurotransmitters in your brain that give you sensations of well-being and reward. And so if a long-distance runner isn't allowed to run for a week or two, it's going to be driving them crazy. They're going to be going through withdrawal, and they're going to be wanting to do it. And so we can think of the tolerance that they've developed as actually being a good thing. The more they've been running in the recent past, within reason, the healthier they'll be and the happier they'll be. And then the final characteristic, which is really important, is reinforcement. And that just means that the amount that you've had in the recent past directly affects the marginal utility you get from this substance today. So the boost in excitement, the boost in happiness you get from consuming the substance is a function of how much you're used to having, right? So your morning coffee gives you more pleasure the more used to having coffee you are. And the converse of that is you're going to suffer more without your morning coffee the more you're used to having it on a typical day. Likewise, I've never had heroin, and I don't miss it. I'm never jonesing for heroin. But somebody who's a heroin addict is used to having it several times a day. When they don't get it, they're going to be really suffering. And when they finally get that heroin, it's going to provide them a huge increase in their happiness. And so that's the idea behind reinforcement. And so something that I find fascinating is that a psychologist, Howard Rockland, at SUNY Stony Brook, found a way to illustrate all these three characteristics using a simple graph. And so the horizontal axis of this graph is the amount that you've consumed in the recent past. So it's the stock of your past consumption. And the horizontal axis is your happiness, your utility. And so the line is telling us, it's translating what your happiness is as a function of that stock of recent consumption. So for example, the line A through D is describing what your happiness looks like as a function of your recent consumption when you're not consuming the addictive good. And the upper line is telling us what your utility or happiness is when you are consuming the addictive good. So all three of those characteristics are depicted here because always and everywhere, your happiness when you're consuming is greater than your happiness when you're not consuming. So that's the concept of withdrawal. Tolerance is saying that the more that you've consumed in the recent past, the less happy you are. So lines A, D, and B, C are sloping down. And then reinforcement says that the boost in happiness that you get from consuming is greater the more you've consumed in the recent past. And so that's why these two lines are diverging as they go from left to right. So somebody like me who's never had heroin, if I took heroin, I'd be moving from A to B. But if I was a hardcore heroin addict, then I'd be moving from D to C. And so, you know, getting a big boost in happiness there. And so you can think of somebody, you know, moving along this graph. So imagine like a 15-year-old who's never had cocaine. So they're at point A. They have no stock of past consumption because they've never had cocaine. And then at a party, somebody gives them some. So instantaneously, their happiness jumps from A to B, their utility. Then when they come down off the high, they don't come down vertically back to A. They come down, but they drift over to the right because now they have a stock of past consumption. And by drifting to the right, they end up lower, their happiness ends up lower than where they started at point A. And so that becomes this incentive to have more cocaine because you're not as happy as you were yesterday before you'd ever had any. And so if the person keeps having cocaine and then coming down off the high, they sort of zigzag all the way over to where they're at point D and they're miserable. Right? So they're a hardcore addict, they're miserable. But the funny thing is that even when they are consuming cocaine as a hardcore addict, they're only at point C, which is way lower than where they started out at point A. And so that explains how in any given moment, it seems to be rational to consume the drug to make yourself happier. But if you're farsighted, you'll notice that you're going to end up in this situation of being a miserable hardcore addict. So it's just a neat way of illustrating those three concepts of addiction. So addiction seems like a really strong word to use sometimes, and so you might wonder what the breadth of topics we can think about using this framework are. But really, increasingly, psychologists and physicians and social scientists are increasingly seeing that many things exhibit these properties of tolerance, withdrawal, and reinforcement, and thus there's reasons to have a very broad interpretation of what's habitual or addictive. So it certainly covers things like drugs, alcohol, and smoking, but like I said, it also covers exercising and being sedentary because, you know, running a long way is more painful the more used to being sedentary you are. Running gets easier the more running you've done. Diet and eating clearly have habitual and addictive properties. The same thing with relationships. It's more enjoyable to be in a marriage the greater the history you have together. And then even things like appreciation of art, wine, and music. The more experience you have, the more enjoyable they are. And so it's just really fascinating that over time, there's been this broader and broader agreement that so many things in life exhibit habitual and addictive properties. So Linden, who's a neuroscientist at Johns Hopkins University, has written that at the biological level, there's now reason to believe that a broad definition of addiction, one that encompasses drugs, sex, food, gambling, even video games, and some other compulsions, is valid. The developing story is that the activation and alteration of the medial forebrain pleasure circuit is at the heart of all these addictions. So basically, we have this pleasure center in our brain that, when we have certain stimuli, releases dopamine or other neurotransmitters that are associated with feelings of reward and well-being. And so we get a dopamine release from drugs, we get it from sex, we get it from eating, you can get it from gambling, you can get it from shopping if that's something that that gives you a lot of utility. And so really all of those activities have the potential to end up being addictions. As mentioned in this quote from Science, that as far as the brain is concerned, a reward's a reward, regardless of whether it comes from a chemical or an experience. And where there's a reward, there's the risk of the vulnerable brain getting trapped in a compulsion. So let's think about I mentioned before that there's really three different ways of thinking about people engaging in habitual and addictive behaviors. So the first, and one of the more extreme, is the model of the irrational addict. So this was really a dominant philosophy in the early days of both of our countries. So for example, during Prohibition, there was this concept in the United States that you just could not responsibly drink alcohol. Like, it didn't matter how educated you were, it didn't matter how responsible a person you were, it was almost like you had a split personality. You could be a regular, wholesome, church-going person, but when you drank alcohol, you'd beat your wife, you'd abuse your kids, and therefore, alcohol had to be taken off the table as a choice. We had to just prohibit the sale and manufacture of alcohol. So if that's true, then what that means is that people do not behave as economists typically model them as behaving, like perfectly rational individuals who can maximize their utility subject to their constraints. But it's consistent with this sort of urban legend that lab rats, that if they're allowed to self-administer cocaine, will do so until they overdose. So in fact, this is only true under really extreme conditions where basically the rats are trained to overdose by taking away all of their stimuli. But if you believe that story, it's very consistent with this irrational addict. And it's also consistent with this quote from the 19th century in the US, which an alcoholic used to describe his addiction. And so this alcoholic said, if there was a keg of rum in one corner of the room and a cannon constantly discharging balls between me and it, I could not refrain from passing before that cannon to get at the rum. So it's that idea of like even life and death risks will not stop an addict from getting their fix. And this view of addiction is really summarized perfectly by this horribly bad movie, Reefer Madness. So Reefer Madness, the movie, was made in 1936 funded by a church group, which wanted to produce this movie to show to parents about the harms of marijuana. And so then it sort of laid dormant for decades until in the 1970s, some pro-marijuana legalization individuals found it, and it sort of spread as this campy, almost joke, goofing on puritanical America's opposition to marijuana. So the clip I'm about to show you, it's a painfully bad movie, but it does illustrate this view that you can't trust people to have any consumption of addictive substance or else they will become crazy. So in this movie, the women become prostitutes, the men become murderers, people commit suicide because of marijuana, and it's all because they took that first puff. After that, they had absolutely no control over their addiction. So music and marijuana go together, right? Paranoia.
I know what you want. You want to kill me.
You're crazy. Take it easy, kid. I just want to talk to you.
So everyone's just gone mad because they had their first puff of marijuana. So at the other end of the spectrum, there's the belief that addicts can be perfectly rational, right? Can be very discriminating consumers of even drugs, right? We certainly tend to think that this might be true for things like wine, right? There could be a very rational wine connoisseur who, is incredibly rational about discerning the properties of the wine and thinking about value, what's the price here. And in economics, the theory of the rational addict was first described or formalized by two economists at the University of Chicago, Gary Becker and Kevin Murphy. And they later said that their title of the paper, The Theory of Rational Addiction, caused them a lot of grief, and that had they known in advance the grief they'd get, they would have retitled it. Because what people interpreted that title to mean is that people enjoy being addicts, and they set out to become addicts. And all that Becker and Murphy meant is that sort of step by step, it's possible that acting on the information that you have, even being aware of the future consequences, that by, you can end up going down this path and ending up an addict. So people are farsighted, they understand the consequences of their actions, and yet addiction is still possible. And this is really depicted in the movie Pretty Woman. So in the movie Pretty Woman, Julia Roberts is a prostitute, Richard Gere is the client. They've just consummated a transaction, and now Richard Gere has decided he wants to contract with her for future transactions. And their language is so dispassionate and precise and businesslike that you would never think that this was about sex. And so this is the kind of approach that you might think people would have if the model of the rational addict was true.
Vivian, I have a business proposition for you.
What do you want?
I'm going to be in town until Sunday. I'd like you to spend the week with me.
Really?
Yes. Yes, I'd like to hire you as an employee. Would you consider spending the week with me? I will pay you to be at my beck and call.
Look, I'd love to be your beck and call girl, but you're a rich, good-looking guy. You could get a million girls free.
I want a professional. I don't need any romantic hassles this week.
If you're talking 24 hours a day, it's gonna cost you.
Oh, yes, of course. All right, here we go. Give me a ballpark figure. How much?
6 full nights, days to 4,000.
6 nights at 300 is 1,800.
You want days too?
2,000.
3,000.
Done.
Holy shit!
Vivian. Vivian, is that a yes?
Yes. Yes. I would have stayed for 2,000.
I would have paid 4. I'll see you tonight.
So from an economics point of view, what's really nice about that scene is you can calculate their gains from trade, right? You know their willingness to pay and willingness to accept the price they actually transacted at, so. The third model lies somewhere in between those two extremes. This third model really is about an imperfectly rational actor. And so we might want to relax some of these strong assumptions of people being so incredibly rational, like is illustrated in this Pretty Woman clip. We might want to allow for rationality to be what economists call bounded, meaning it's limited. So one way it could be bounded is that people are just limited in their abilities to solve problems or process information or calculate risks. Or it may be possible to do it, but it's really costly. Like, how fun would your life be if you literally had, at every possible decision node in your life, you had to calculate the expected costs and benefits of each decision through the rest of your life and discount the benefits and costs all the way back? And instead, we don't do that. Instead, we tend to have rules of thumb, little heuristics that help us get through life without having to do these extensive calculations. Another possibility is that people may have different preferences for the future. So a discount rate in economics refers to the extent to which people discount happiness that's only received in the future. So for example, if you offered me $1,000 today or $1,000 tomorrow, well, of course I'd take it today. I mean, why bother to wait? And so you kind of have to compensate me for waiting. You have to say $1,000 today or maybe $1,050 tomorrow, and that extra 50 compensates me for having to wait. And it's a reflection of my rate of time discount. You know, how much more you have to compensate me for waiting. And so it may be that people's discount rates are really complicated, and they have one kind of discount rate for decisions that are in the distant future, and a different discount rate for decisions or trade-offs that are in the very sort of recent future. And so, I might say that I would love to save so much money that I'm a multimillionaire by the time I retire. I would love to do that. I'd love to find a way to do that. But if you came to me and said, would I like to save half of my take-home pay today? So like, no, I don't want to save half my take-home pay. I have lots of ideas of how to spend that take-home pay, and I want some immediate gratification. And so that's an illustration of how people really might want to do the thing that's right in the long run for their future, but when it comes to trade-offs between today and tomorrow, it just doesn't ever seem to be the right time to start sacrificing for the good of tomorrow. And this would explain why people keep saying things like, I really want to quit smoking. I think I'll start next week, but they never do. Or I'm going to have a New Year's resolution to lose weight, but I break it every year very quickly. And so this is a kind of interesting situation where people are expressing one preference for the distant future that's different from their short-run behavior. So what's interesting is that, this sort of jives very well with what we observe in real life, but what's kind of an interesting wrinkle to this is, to what extent are people aware that they repeatedly do this? So if people are aware that they repeatedly do this, then we'll call them sophisticated. But if they never catch on that they keep having the same New Year's resolution to lose weight and never fulfill it, then we'll call them naive. And that difference is really important because if you're sophisticated, then you can maybe plan ahead and find ways of constraining your future self in terms of their actions. So the neat thing is you can think of each of us as playing a game against future versions of ourselves. Like if you lined up each day of your life and think of them as a different version of you, if you are a smoker and you want to quit smoking, you as the person today have to play a game against all future versions of you that are going to want to keep smoking. And can you find a way to constrain future you from smoking? And with saving, can you do something to constrain future you not to spend all the money you make, but to save it? So an example of an imperfectly rational addict and yet someone who's sophisticated is illustrated by the character Frank the Tank in the movie Old School. So Frank is a guy who's in his 30s, but when he was in college, he would drink a lot, he'd binge drink, and he'd become like another person. So that part's like the Reefer Madness view of addiction. But what makes it different is that he has learned that he's like that. And so he's sophisticated about it, so he tries to find ways to avoid having that personality come out and take control. And so in this clip, he's talking to his wife about wanting to go to a party where there's going to be alcohol, and she's concerned that if he goes, that the sort of Frank the Tank character comes out and it'll be like Reefer Madness all over again. But he assures her that because he's sophisticated about it, that he'll find ways to avoid that problem happening again.
You've come a long way since Frank the Tank, and we don't want him coming back now, do we?
Honey. Frank the Tank is not coming back, okay? That part of me is over. It's water under the bridge. I promise.
Pardon me, I just...
Oops, sorry.
Through there.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you.
Oh, what's up?
Yo, what's up, man? How you doing?
Oh, no, that's my friend Mitch. You're mistaken. speaking of me, that's my friend Mitch. He owns that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Anyway, yo, man, come hit this right here. You need to hit this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, hit that. No, I appreciate it, but I told my wife I wouldn't drink tonight. Besides, I got a big day tomorrow. But you guys have a great time.
A big day? You doing what?
Well, actually, pretty nice little Saturday. We're gonna go to Home Depot. Yeah, buy some wallpaper, maybe get some flooring, stuff like that. Maybe Bed Bath & Beyond. I don't know. I don't know if we'll have enough time.
You did. You know what?
Give me that thing. I'll do one. I'll do one.
We gonna do one.
I'll do one.
We gonna do one.
Do
you, baby? Oh! That's a talented man.
So yeah, so definitely the reefer madness side to him, but he was aware of it, he was sophisticated, but he overestimated his own degree of self-control, and that led to a failure. So something that's kind of interesting is, you know, when you think about the happiness or utility that people get out of consuming habitual and addictive substances, is not just the instantaneous pleasure of a drug or alcohol or nicotine, but there's another component to it that's related to the economic concept of derived demand. So derived demand is about, is described as a situation where you demand something not just because of its instantaneous utility properties to you, but because it helps you produce something else that you value. And in this case, when you think about youths engaging in risky health behaviors, in many cases they may be doing it because it's a derived demand. So nobody, I would argue, the first time they have a cigarette enjoys it, right? It's horrible, you cough, but so why do people persist? They're not addicted to nicotine after one puff or one cigarette. They persist because it helps them produce something else that they want, which might be coolness, right? Or the edgy sort of reputation, or it allows you to hang out with the older kids or the tough kids. Likewise, when you think of like a 14-year-old girl initiating sex, it might be for the pleasure of the act, but in many cases it might be a derived demand, derived from her demand to keep an older boyfriend. So she's giving him something that he wants to keep him with her, and so, you know, this is a reason that people engage in risky health behaviors. So this relates to the concept of peer effects. And Liebenstein in 1950 distinguished two different kinds of peer effects. One is the bandwagon effect, and that says that you might get extra happiness or utility out of doing things that other people do. Right? So it's fun to go and have a glass of wine with somebody else. It's fun to go and chat over coffee. That's the bandwagon effect. But there's also a snob effect. And the snob effect is actually the opposite, that you get less utility out of doing something that many other people are doing. You get utility out of doing something that very few people are doing. So, you know, the one time my wife went to a party and she was wearing the same dress as somebody else, that wasn't great, right? There was no bandwagon effect of them being so happy somebody else wore the same dress. Instead, it was a violation of the snob effect. There was disappointment that, oh, now we look like we're, you know, this is a cheap or easy dress to get, and they were both left feeling worse off. So something that's kind of interesting is that this concept of coolness or peer acceptance that maybe many youths and probably many adults are after is a delicate balance of the bandwagon effect and the snob effect. So you don't want to do something that literally everybody else does, that's not particularly cool. There's some kind of critical mass. You want to do something that enough other people are doing that they can validate that you know what you're doing and you're cool. Because there's no point in doing something completely alone. So the interesting thing is that when people rebel against the majority, they often rebel in a very predictable way that a substantial number of other people are also engaging in. Right? So think of kids who were goth, right? Like my niece. So she dresses all in black, wears white makeup. It's like, it's a cliche, right? This goth concept has been around for decades. If she truly wanted to rebel, she'd pick something completely independent of what everybody else is doing and be the only person doing it. But she doesn't really want the pure snob effect. She wants the snob effect from 90% of society, but a bandwagon effect with 5% of society. So she wants to be part of a group, just not the majority. And so what's complicated is that what's cool keeps changing, right? You can't keep doing the same thing year after year and stay cool, right? So fashions change on purpose so that some people can be at the cutting edge, right? And so this whole balance, this delicate balance of coolness, and how there's a derived demand for things, especially by youth, to help them produce coolness, but yet what is cool keeps changing is really well illustrated in this clip from South Park. So this is not about drugs or alcohol, but it's still about purchasing things in the marketplace that help you produce coolness, but you're frustrated because what's cool keeps changing.
Tune in tomorrow for another inexplicable episode of Chimpokomon.
Hooray!
Hey kids, do you love Chimpokomon?
Yes.
Well now you can buy your very own. I've got to buy Chimpokomon. I've got to buy it. I've got to buy it. Now you can collect them all. Furry cat, donkey trunk, pingin, shoe, lamptor. Collect them all and you can become Royal Crown Chimpokomaster.
Royal Crown Chimpokomaster, holy shit.
All the Chimpokomon are in stores now.
Chimpokomon is super you love toy number one.
Got to buy it, Chimpokomon.
Man, shut it. This is a toy store, Mom. Now, must go. Toy store.
Eric, calm down.
Mom, must go. Must buy.
What is it, Eric?
Mom, I've only just heard. They're making some Pokemon dolls, Mom. You can collect them all. You can collect them all, Mother. Quick, we must get to the toy store.
I'm making us some lunch right now, Eric.
But, Mom, I have to get a Pokemon doll before everybody else does, because then I'll be cool.
Can't it wait till tomorrow, hon?
But, Mom, I have to get the first one and people won't think I'm cute.
All right, let's go.
Everybody's going to be so jealous when they see my Chimpokomon.
I will.
Oh, God damn it. Okay, Kenny, I'll trade you my Choo-Choo Nezumi for your Pingin. God damn it, you're supposed to trade, you little asshole. Give me Pingin.
Hey, dudes, what are those?
What are these? They're Chimpokomon.
Huh?
You don't appear to have any Chimpokomon.
No, but look, I just got this sweet Cyborg Bill doll.
Oh, please, Cyborg Bill is so yesterday.
Yeah, like ancient history. Cyborg Bill isn't cool anymore?
No, dude. Cyborg Bill hasn't been cool for a long time, Cal.
Why the hell don't people tell me these things?
It's all Chimpokomon now.
Dude, if you collect Chimpokomon, you can complete the primary main objective. What's the primary main objective?
You don't even know what the primary main objective is?
The primary main objective is to destroy the evil power. Well, what's the evil power?
Oh my god! The identity of the evil power won't be revealed until all Chimpokomon are collected by Royal Crown Chimpokomaster.
What?
God, get with the times, dude.
Yeah, I guess so.
Mom, Dad, can I have money to buy Chimpokomon?
What's a Chimpokomon?
I'm not sure.
Well, why do you need one?
I don't know.
Well, then the answer is no, Kyle. You just got money to buy your Cyborg Bill doll.
Yeah, but Cyborg Bill is totally gay now. Please, Mom, everybody else has Chimpokomon.
Well, Kyle, that's not a reason to buy something.
Thank God, don't.
You see, son, fads come and go. And this Chimpokomon is obviously nothing more than a fad. You don't have to be a part of it. In fact, you can make an even stronger statement by saying to your peers, I'm not going to be a part of this fad because I'm an individual. Do you understand?
Yes. Yes, I do, Dad. Now let me tell you how it works in the real world. In the real world, I can either get a Chimpokomon or I can be the only kid without one, which singles me out and causes the other kids to make fun of me and kick my ass.
Good point. Here's $10.
Thanks.
Wait, here's 20. Get one for your brother, too.
Thank Buggle.
Hey, Zyke, check out my sweet Chimpokomon doll.
Oh, please. Chimpokomon dolls are so last week.
What?
Yeah, dude, don't you know? It's all about the Chimpokomon video game now. Did you bring your special Chimpokomon game controller?
Huh? No.
Oh, you didn't get a special Chimpokomon game controller. Jesus Christ.
Right, so you can think of the same thing happening with fashion. It's constantly this changing definition of what's cool, and it's clearly this balance between bandwagon effects, they want to do what the other kids are doing, but also snob effects because it's time sensitive. If you wait, then too many people are doing it, it's not cool anymore, so it has to keep changing. So we've got these three different models of risky health behaviors. We've got the irrational addict, the rational addict, and the imperfectly rational addict. And which of them is correct is actually really important for suggesting which public policies will be effective in decreasing these risky health behaviors that are contributing to millions of deaths worldwide each year. If we think that the irrational actor from Reefer Madness is the correct model, then that suggests that people are unresponsive to prices, they're not going to listen when we warn them about risks, they're probably going to ignore any information we give them. And so this really gives you the strongest case for simply prohibiting the substance altogether. Like I said, this is how the temperance movement viewed alcohol, that you just need to absolutely ban it, not give people the choice, because, you know, be like Reefer Madness. An alcoholic is absolutely unreasonable person. On the other hand, if you think the rational actor is correct, like in Pretty Woman, then taxes can be effective in decreasing consumption. New information might alter people's decisions. And you could even have little public service announcements that are designed to trigger what are called social taboo effects. And this is a bandwagon effect in reverse. So basically, convince people that this risky health behavior is so rare and odd and only engaged in by people who are not very smart or mentally ill that nobody wants to be involved with it. But the risk here is that the government may not be a very good advertiser and may come up with public health campaigns that are so ham-handed that they actually backfire. So there's communications researchers who study what are called boomerang effects, of where, the public service announcements designed by the government are just so uncool to kids that they actually kind of make kids feel that they're obligated to defy government and go out and start taking these substances. Now, if we believe instead this model of the imperfectly rational actor, then taxes, information, public service announcements, they're probably less influential than if people were perfectly rational, but they may still be influential, and it's not like a Reefer Madness situation. But the really unique prediction of the imperfectly rational actor model is that people who are sophisticated about their time and consistent preferences are going to want pre-commitment devices, ways that they can lock in their decisions to prevent the future versions of themselves from engaging in risky health behaviors. So the classic example is that Odysseus, when he was warned that the sirens had this addictive siren song that would, lead captains astray and lead them to wreck their ships, he wanted to hear the song, but he didn't want the damage, so he had his crew lash him to the mast, and he had them put beeswax in their ears. So Odysseus and the mast is actually sort of this shorthand for finding pre-commitment devices to stop your future self from doing harm. And so this is why people flush cigarettes down the toilet when they're trying to quit. I mean, why don't they just throw them in the garbage can? If they've decided not to smoke anymore, just throw them away. You don't have to go do this dramatic gesture. Well, the answer is because they don't trust their future selves. They have learned from experience that future them will go and be digging them out of the garbage the next day, and so they have to destroy them. Likewise, an addict who knows he wants to quit can go check himself into rehab, where, at least in the U.S., once you check yourself in, you can't get out for 72 hours. You've waived your right to leave. And it's precisely this idea that the addict, when he's going through withdrawal, can't be trusted, and we can't allow the future version of you who's going through withdrawal to make any decisions that could affect your ability to stay on this path of abstinence. As Colm said, one of my interests is obesity, and so bariatric surgery, which is an increasingly popular surgery, is a great example of a pre-commitment device. So bariatric surgery, what it does is they reduce the size of your stomach, typically, to the size of a walnut, and then bypass most of your upper intestine so that the contents of your stomach are routed to your lower intestine. And so this is a pre-commitment device because by shrinking the size of your stomach, it physically limits the amount you're able to eat. If you overeat, you're going to vomit because your stomach can't hold it. And then the other thing is that the food is then routed to your lower intestine, which is not used to receiving rich food from the stomach, and so it causes distress at the other end. And so it's basically just negative reinforcement. It's just teaching you, it's punishing you for eating. And it's one of the very few things that's effective for helping people lose a lot of weight and keep it off. Now, even still, because you can stretch out the size of the stomach over time, people tend to gain weight after several years, but the benefits are dramatic. And antabuse is another example of a pre-commitment device. So this is a prescription drug that you can take in the morning, and then if you drink later that day, it makes you violently ill. So this is fascinating because before I was giving this example of today you versus future you, but in this case, it's morning guy versus evening guy. Right? It's the same day. The same person is taking antabuse in the morning, not wanting to drink later that night. And the challenge, though, with all of these things is this pre-commitment device has to be unbreakable because future you is just as smart as today you, right? And future you is going to be looking for ways to get out of that out of the binds that you've put him in. So Odysseus fought valiantly to get out from his bonds. But he couldn't escape, and so happily the crew and he survived. But with bariatric surgery, people can circumvent it afterwards by drinking things like milkshakes that don't, aren't constrained by the size of the stomach. And then with antabuse, if you go online, there's chat rooms that'll help you undo the effects of antabuse. So 3 hours after you take antabuse, you can be out scheming to undo what you yourself did 3 hours ago. So it just shows how people have time inconsistent preferences. And when you design these pre-commitment devices, you have to find ones that are unbreakable, which is very hard to do. So here's an example of somebody trying to find a pre-commitment device to help them break a habit as regards sex.
She wants to be an actress. She makes me read these moronic acting things with her, and I do it because I'm so addicted to the sex, I'm helpless. I'll do anything. So finally, Kramer comes in the other day. Kramer, I don't want to see this woman anymore, but I haven't got the willpower to throw out her number. Please help me. I'm proud of you. So, I'm never gonna see her again. I'm going cold turkey. Come on, Kramer. Seriously, give me your number.
I don't have it. I threw it out.
You're lying. You've got it. I want that number.
I told you. I threw it out. Give it to me.
But you told me not to give it to you. You made me promise.
Well, I changed my mind. I want that number.
No, you said no matter what you do or say, I'm not to give you the number.
I was lying. Give it to me.
No, you told me not to.
I want the number.
You're lying. Yeah. Look at you. Look at what you've sunk to. Look at what you've become. Look in the mirror. Because you need help, Jerry. You need help. Because I can't stand by and do it anymore. It's turning my stomach. I can't stand around here watching you destroy yourself. It's eating me up inside.
All right, so yesterday Jerry thought he found this great pre-commitment device of giving Kramer the number, but then the next day Jerry wanted to undo that pre-commitment device. And isn't it funny how in such a short time it's anachronistic of having someone's number like on a piece of paper that if lost you could never find them again, right? There's no smartphones with her number programmed into it. There's no Google so he can find her number. So let me just describe for you what we know from economics research about the extent to which people do respond to incentives. So this will help us figure out, are people, you know, who are on drugs, engaging in risky sex, drinking, obese, to what extent are they insensitive to information, prices, trade-offs, or are they more rational? So the types of incentives we care about are things like prices, because maybe we can affect those through taxes, the non-price components of total cost, so the time cost of acquiring cigarettes, for example, or the risks involved in cigarettes, information, do people respond to that, and then finally peer effects. And throughout this part, I'll be talking about elasticities, and that's just a concept from economics that describes what's the percent change in quantity consumed in response to a 1% change in price. So first of all, there's an enormous amount of research that's established beyond any doubt that cigarette smoking responds to price. And so this is data, these are results from a meta-analysis that was done of literally hundreds of studies of this question. And so I'll just quickly point out that whether we're talking about men or women, whether we're talking about adults, young adults, or teens, all of these people have non-zero responses to price. So what these numbers mean, these are the average elasticities in the far right-hand column number of studies. And so for men, for example, that number, negative 0.50, that tells us if prices went up by, let's say, 10%, that men's demand for cigarettes would fall by 5%. So it's not a one-to-one relationship, but still, you know, dropping cigarette smoking by 5% would be really nice. And you can get that with a 10% tax is what that implies. So you might think that the people we care most about are teenagers because they're ones at risk of developing habits. And so happily, they actually have a higher price elasticity. So let's say a 10% increase in cigarette prices will decrease teen smoking by 14.3%. So happily, cigarette smokers absolutely respond to price. What's kind of curious, though, economists love unintended consequences of government policies. This is just sort of in our DNA. And so a couple interesting studies that relate to cigarette taxes are that cigarette smokers don't just sort of passively start smoking less. They're shrewd, right? They're like Jerry Seinfeld. They're trying to find a way around this policy. And so one thing that's been documented that they do is they switch to cigarettes that are higher in nicotine. So they do smoke less, but they're getting more nicotine than you might think because they're upgrading to higher nicotine cigarettes. Moreover, other research has established that this compensating behavior can be so large that nicotine intake might not even be changed, or tar intake. Tar is sort of a marker for the carcinogenic risk of the cigarettes. So people are smoking less, but they might be smoking riskier cigarettes with not much change in risk overall. It's not just cigarettes that are responsive, cigarette smoking that's responsive to price, but also alcohol consumption. So these are data from another meta-analysis, and you can see there's over 100 studies that have been conducted of individuals' price responsiveness in terms of drinking alcohol. And the price elasticities indicate that if the price of beer went up by 10%, that drinking of beer would go down by 4.6%. Price of wine goes up 10%, wine consumption would drop by 6.9%. And if you put a 10% tax on if you raise the price of distilled spirits or hard alcohol by 10%, consumption would fall by 8%. So something that's interesting, too, is what's the price responsiveness of heavy drinkers? Because these are the people we're really worried about in terms of imposing costs on society through liver cirrhosis, through drunk driving. And so they are less price responsive. So heavy drinkers, they still respond to price, but only about half as much as the average person does. And there's other evidence that heavy drinkers are less price responsive than average. The third point here says that a dollar increase in the beer tax has no detectable effect on binge drinking by youths. Right? So the demand of youths for drinking on the weekend, drinking large quantities, drinking in college, may not be very responsive to beer prices. And then the last point is that beer prices also have no detectable effect on heavy drinking by men. So there's substantial evidence that binge drinking, heavy drinking aren't particularly price responsive. So this isn't perfectly aligning with the perfectly rational model, but yet people are still somewhat responsive. A major interest these days in policy circles is, could we potentially decrease prevalence of overweight and obesity by taxing energy-dense foods, where the word energy-dense just means high calorie? So in particular, people are interested in taxes on soda pop. Those have been proposed in New York State, for example. Denmark recently instituted a tax on foods that are high in saturated fat. And so the studies that have been done, which are much fewer than the studies that have been done on smoking and alcohol, between really a dozen and 20 studies have been conducted, but soft drinks, fats and oils, and sweets and sugars are all responsive to price. Again, less than a one-to-one ratio, but still people do respond in terms of their consumption. Other research has gone farther and said, okay, but do soft drink taxes, for example, or taxes on fats in milk products, could those actually help decrease population weights? And the evidence suggests that these taxes have very little effect, if any, on weight. So one study found that even a 10% tax on dairy fat would reduce average fat consumption by less than a percentage point, and some work by Jason Fletcher and his colleagues found really no detectable impact of soft drink taxes on weight. And part of that might be because there really haven't been any enormous soft drink taxes that could have a gigantic effect. At least the ones in the U.S. average only 2.7% of the price of a soda pop. And so it's possible that a bigger tax might have an effect, but there's no proof based on what we currently know that it would. So a really tough test of whether addicts are, you know, rational, irrational, or imperfectly rational is, do drug users respond to prices? And the answer, again, is yes. So interestingly, marijuana is the least price responsive of the drugs that have been studied. A 10% increase in marijuana prices would only decrease marijuana use by 3%. Cocaine is price responsive at a one-to-one ratio, and heroin is price responsive almost at a one-to-one ratio. And this is true for both using or not using drugs, that's the first column, and then even conditional on using drugs, when the price of cocaine goes up, cocaine users use less. So really strong evidence that even when it comes to addictive habitual activities, that people still respond to incentives. So a classic example of people responding to incentives when prices change for drugs is the Australian heroin drought that took place from 2000 to 2001. And this study is focused on Cabramatta, right, which is a suburb to the southwest, is that right? And so increased law enforcement in Australia led to a more than doubling of the price of heroin around Christmas of the year 2000. And so a study that focused on Cabramatta found that in response to this doubling of the price of heroin, the frequency of use, number of times a day, fell by more than a third. So people who on average had been taking it 23 times a week, injecting heroin, dropped to 15 times a week. Total expenditures on heroin fell from $550 a week to $350 a week. That's more than a third of a reduction. And then overall, the elasticity of spending on heroin to price among regular users was negative 0.32, meaning if you could raise the price of heroin by 10%, you'd reduce use among heroin users by 3.2%. So even heavy heroin users are responsive to price. And the payoff is that when the price goes up, you get less of a healthcare cost for society. So what this graph shows you is month by month during this the heroin drought, which again kicked in December of this year, you can see the number of overdoses, both in Cabramatta specifically on the left-hand side axis, vertical axis, and then the total number of overdoses in all of New South Wales. And so as you can see, they fell from about 60 per month prior to the heroin drought. They dropped to between 10 and 20. So a huge reduction in heavy use of heroin because the price of heroin doubled. So this is really fascinating. It clearly is inconsistent with the reefer madness view of drug use. So another neat and innovative way of taking advantage of the fact that drug users are responsive to price is the whole field of contingency management. So contingency management is an obscure, fancy term that just refers to basically paying people to stay off of drugs. So just calling it something like we pay addicts to stay clean wouldn't have a whole lot of support potentially among the population, so they have this sort of technical sounding term, contingency management. But the basic idea is that when somebody's already in drug rehab, trying to get off of heroin and cocaine, that in exchange for every negative test result you get in a urine test, like something where you can really prove whether they're on drugs or not, each negative test result, you give them a voucher. And the voucher can be as small as being worth $2.50 that they could redeem for like iTunes or save up and pick prizes out of a catalog. And they found that you have to give people vouchers because it's a bad idea to give drug addicts cash. And a meta-analysis that looked at these studies found overwhelming evidence that the incentives of vouchers increase abstinence. Right? So an average of 30% improvement in abstinence for giving people vouchers. And you get better results the more valuable the voucher and the more quickly you give people the reinforcement. So as soon as you get that negative test result, you want to get that voucher in their hands so they immediately associate good things with staying clean. And something that's really fascinating about this area is how cheap the vouchers really are. Like I said, $2.50 is enough to improve abstinence for cocaine addicts, just paying $137 on average over a three-month period. So really cheap compared to the potential crime costs, healthcare costs of people continuing an addiction. So motivated by this, I became very interested with respect to obesity. How effective would it be to pay people rewards in exchange for them losing weight? And so we evaluated a workplace program that offered its overweight and obese employees financial rewards for weight loss. And so, for example, you could earn $30 per quarter if you lost 10% of your starting weight. And what we found is that it didn't work well. So basically, it works. Something that works well for staying off of heroin and cocaine doesn't work well when it comes to weight loss, which to me is a real reminder of how difficult it is to break the habits associated with diet and physical activity. So we saw super high attrition, even though everybody was a volunteer, nobody paid to be part of this, everybody was only at risk of winning somebody else's money. 50% of the people dropped out in the first quarter, and more than three quarters of them had quit by the end of the year. Even the people who stayed in only lost an average of 1.4 to 3.6 pounds, and even the control group that got no financial rewards lost an average 1.7 pounds that year. So in some cases, the treatment actually lowered, not statistically significant, but they actually had lower weight loss than the control group. This is consistent with another randomized control trial that was conducted by Eric Finkelstein. He found no effective financial incentives on weight loss after 6 months. And there's a neat paper where these economists got data from the British bookmaker William Hill, and William Hill gets free publicity by taking bets from people who want to lose a lot of weight. And so they have a doctor ensure that the person can safely lose that amount of weight and that the rate of weight loss is safe. And what's fascinating is that despite the fact that on average these people could have won $2,300 by losing the weight that they wanted to lose, 80% of them fail. And so again, it's this reminder that while contingency management works for drug addiction, paying people financial rewards for weight loss is having much less success. And it's a fascinating question, I think, to figure out why. But it is a testament to how hard it is to change these habits. You can stay off of cocaine forever and never be tempted again. You have to eat every day. And so every time you eat, you're at risk of relapse. So addictive behaviors are responsive not just to prices. They're also responsive to other components of cost. So, for example, if you make it harder for people to smoke by passing clean indoor air laws that force them to go outside to smoke, that has a documented effect in lowering rates of smoking. If you make it harder for teenagers to buy cigarettes by banning their sale in vending machines, for example, that lowers teen smoking. If you make it harder for teenagers to get alcohol by raising the minimum drinking age, you can reduce the likelihood of teenagers using by 5.5%. But there's an unintended consequence, which economists always love. John DiNardo at Michigan has found that when states raise their minimum purchase age for alcohol from 18 to 21 in the U.S., that the prevalence of marijuana consumption rose by 2.4 percentage points. So in other words, if you make one thing more expensive, people will look for a close substitute and switch to that. If they can't get the alcohol, they switch to marijuana. If you increase fines for possessing drugs, you get less drug use. If you decriminalize marijuana, you get more use. When it comes to risky sex, states that have a high prevalence of AIDS, you see girls staying virgins longer. So they're responsive to the risks of unprotected sex. Among gay males in the United States, you see more condom use in states that have a higher prevalence of AIDS. So people respond to risks even when it comes to emotional activities like sexual activity. People also are responsive to information. So when the U.S. Surgeon General in 1964 released his first report about the health harms of smoking, the prevalence of smoking in the U.S. dropped by 5% almost immediately. So even though by 1964 people had a good idea about the health harms, making it really salient in public, getting a lot of publicity for it, had an immediate detectable impact. Likewise with food, the Nutrition Facts Panel, which appears on all prepared foods in the United States, led consumers to switch away from high-fat to lower-fat foods, and we found that it reduced obesity among certain groups in the population, like white females. However, menu labels, which were recently mandated in New York State, appear to have little detectable impact on people's eating. So it still might be good to have because people can make informed decisions, but it's just not having much of an impact on eating. And also, people are even responsive to information when it comes to sex. So there was an experiment in Kenya where the researchers went in and informed teen girls that if they have unprotected sex with older men, they're at a higher risk of contracting AIDS. And you know, in, taught them about wearing condoms and how that would decrease the risk of transmission. And so after that experiment, the treatment group girls significantly decreased sexual activity with older men. So pregnancy by older men dropped by 61%, but they had more sex with boys. Because what you just told them is men are dangerous, so they substituted to a close substitute, they went to boys, but they also did utilize condoms. So even when it comes to sexual activity, we still see people acting in a very rational way. Moreover, there's an abundance of evidence that addictive behaviors respond to peers, and these are some really neat studies because they rely on some sort of natural experiment, because you can't just compare me and my friends and see if we affect each other because we chose each other, and maybe we chose each other because we all like to drink and smoke together. So you have to look for instances where people don't choose their peers, and so some really neat research has, for example, looked at the random assignment of military cadets to different units, and what they found is that random assignment indicates that there's substantial peer effects in physical fitness. So if you're lucky enough to end up in assigned to a squadron where people are really physically fit, you will become more fit than if you'd been assigned to a squadron with less fit people. Some researchers have used a random roommate assignment in colleges and found that girls tend to pick up each other's weight loss behaviors based on this randomization. So a lot of evidence, too, that people respond to peers. So putting together all this evidence, really what it suggests is overwhelmingly, the people respond to incentives. They respond to prices, they respond to non-price costs, they respond to information and peer effects at both the extensive and intensive margins, extensive margin being use or not use, and intensive margin meaning how much do you use conditional on using. But people don't respond to every incentive, right? Sometimes we see less price responsiveness among the heavy drinkers, for example. So there's definitely suggestive evidence as well that people have time and consistent preferences. Like I said, the rise of bariatric surgery and so on. And so people are seeking out pre-commitment devices. So what this suggests really is that maybe the right model that we should use is the model of the imperfectly rational actor like Frank the Tank. So he may be the new homo economicus, which is in economics the term for economic man. So what is this? What are the takeaway points then? Like, how do you use this? So the implications for health policy are that taxes and other policies that affect cash price may well be effective in reducing addictive behaviors. However, the heaviest users may be least responsive. The heavy drinking was not very much affected by price changes. Binge drinking by teenagers was not at all affected by beer taxes. And then keep in mind that consumers will respond shrewdly. So if you tax cigarettes, people will switch to higher tar nicotine cigarettes. The teenagers, when you made it illegal for them to buy alcohol, switched to marijuana. We also can be confident that provision of health information is a good thing. It can help reduce addictive behaviors, like in the 1964 Surgeon General's report about smoking, the information intervention in Kenya about AIDS risks. And then the third thing to keep in mind is that based on the research of communications departments, as I mentioned before, public health campaigns that are designed to decrease the use of addictive substances can backfire. It could unintentionally increase the bandwagon effect if it convinces kids, first of all, that lots of people are engaged in that behavior. So if you put out some, a PSA, a public service announcement that said, drug use in America's high schools is a crisis, then the kids who aren't using drugs might be thinking, like, I'm such a loser. Like, everybody else is doing this. Why aren't I doing this? Moreover, if the message is conceived to be so ham-handed that teens feel like they couldn't possibly comply with that without looking dorky, then there's again this risk of a bandwagon effect. So the one I remember from when I was a kid is video games used to have this image when they weren't actively playing a game that said winners don't use drugs. And like for a teenager, that just sounds really just cheesy. It makes you sound like if the government thinks that, then maybe I should be on drugs because I don't want to be somebody that the government thinks is a winner. And then let me give you, in closing, I'll just show you one last video clip that'll conclude this lecture that shows how the kids in South Park reacted when they were inflicted with a public service announcement called Butt Out, which is designed to get them to never initiate smoking.
Now, kids, we have a really fun motivational group today who are going to talk to you about the dangers of smoking, okay? So please give a very big South Park howls welcome to Butt Out.
Oh,
cigarette butt throw. But but kids got to go.
Oh no.
Remember, kids, if you smoke, you could grow up to be a failure.
Worse yet, you could grow up to be dead.
So don't believe what those evil tobacco companies tell you.
Yeah, because if you don't smoke, you can grow up to be
just like us.
Yeah, give me another one. Give me another one. Dude, this is really hard.
Thanks.
While I was sitting there, I was reminded of a qualitative study of Irish college students that we did. And they were asked what a kind of normal night. They said, well, six cans is the normal, like, this is direct quotes. So it's used a friends like Californian language. So that's 12 units before you even hit the nightclub. But then you go in and have a few drinks to get into the mood of the nightclub or whatever. So you can have 3 pints, and then you're up to 18 units. And then you'd have a few other drinks and stuff like, that's like a typical college night. And I think the terminology of binge drinking is pretty ridiculous. And the girl sitting beside him says, and I know it sounds bad, but I'd usually have a naggin of vodka, probably. A naggin's a half bottle of vodka before going to the nightclub. So I think your perception of messages about binge drinking flying over the heads of that cohort are well taken. Turner Force and John, we've got a bit of time for questions. And I'm sure there's plenty, so please fire ahead.
Yeah, that's a great point. So since it wasn't caught on the microphone, I'll just repeat that the question related to whether there's an innate human need for altered consciousness, and then does this explain why people are so dedicated to circumventing policies and substituting one thing for another? And it's funny you mention that, because I every time I see my kids on the playground going crazy, going around and around on the merry-go-round, and just loving spinning until they fall down from dizziness. I think, like, you know, like, ever since I could buy alcohol, I just don't get into spinning until I can fall. You know, it kind of gets at your point of, you know, I don't need to. I've got a substitute way of feeling dizzy if I want to. And so, yeah, I think that's a really fascinating question. And and so the circumvention through, so this is the other thing that it reminded me of is, so recently I was part of this Food and Drug Administration the Food and Drug Administration asked some economists to come and provide input on what they should do, because the Food and Drug Administration has only recently been given the authority to regulate the tobacco industry in the U.S. Previously, their hands were tied because of the lobbying power of big tobacco. And their question, which was, I thought, really eye-opening and fascinating, was, if we could, like, nicotine, which is the addictive part, which is the addictive substance that you get from smoking, there's nothing bad about it. So you can get a nicotine patch, you can get nicotine gum. It doesn't cause cancer. What causes cancer is the inhaling of the, you know, the tar and other things that are burning. So their point was, what if we could come up with a perfectly safe way of smoking, like an e-cigarette, right, where you just get the nicotine and there's no health harms? Should we approve that? And it really gets at what you're asking, because I think people's knee-jerk reaction is, there's got to be something wrong with that. Like, why would you facilitate people becoming addicted? But if it doesn't harm your health, and like you said, like, if there's this innate human need for an altered consciousness, then maybe this is a great idea, because then you can safely use this as a substitute for all these other more harmful things you could be doing.
Hi. Great presentation. Thank you. I had a question related to the previous question, but with the contingency management, mm-hmm. I believe, and the vouchers, were there results that, or were there any statistics obtained or data obtained after the vouchers were stopped giving to see what were the, while they're getting the vouchers, they're staying clean, as soon as the vouchers stop, they relapse again. Is there any evidence as to that? And as it goes to this idea, is it just a, you know, you give them a reward of a, the voucher, the $250 in iTunes, once that's gone, they resubstitute, or they substitute back to their original behaviors?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so sometimes another way to phrase that is, does the provision of extrinsic rewards lead to a depreciation of your intrinsic motivation? So if I start paying you to do something that you originally wanted to do anyway, by the time I take away the rewards, have you lost your intrinsic motivation? Do you instead feel like, well, I'm not doing that anymore, nobody's paying me? Like, that's the real risk with these. So I, off the top of my head, I don't remember from the contingency management studies. What we found from the paying for weight loss study is that even though we got these really modest results, they those modest results depreciate. 80% of those losses were regained within a few months. So it's definitely true that when you take away the rewards, a lot of the benefits can disappear. And then it's something that would worry you even more is, could you actually end up worse off because now you feel like, why should I ever lose weight if somebody's not paying me to do it? Yeah. But
no, I will be good. I would like to know if there is any cost-benefit analysis done on the legalization of drugs in the U.S., and if there are many, what is the best, and what do you think about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think, so the short answer is no, and the problem is just you never observe the counterfactual. We don't know what the U.S. would look like if drugs were legalized, and so I think that makes risk-averse people very, very wary about experimenting with liberalizing the drug laws. The short answer is we don't have like hard evidence on what the world would look like under a very different set of drug laws.
Hi, you just mentioned three models of addiction at the very front of your presentation, and sort of came up with a conclusion that maybe the guy who has limited information is probably the best model. Is there any sort of evidence that people move in between those three models of addiction? So, for example, you know, if you're going from a rational to an irrational model of addiction, and then can you push people back from irrational to rational and then hit them with another policy to then get them to stop what they're doing? So sort of interacting policy to shift people between those three models?
I think you're absolutely right. And so even in that clip, like about Frank the Tank, there was a part of him that was irrational. And what made him imperfectly rational was his awareness of it, his sophistication about it, an attempt to control it through different pre-commitment strategies. So absolutely, like there's no reason. So I'm presenting them as three almost mutually exclusive models, but they're really not. I mean, you could imagine, like you said, the same person passing through different stages at different times. One might be true. So perfectly rational might be true for smoking, but for LSD, it could be reefer madness. I mean, who knows, like once you've taken it, you really have no understanding of reality, and I can lecture you all I want about the risks, but I'm not getting through. So it could differ for substances. You know, there's been research on the teenage brain and how the teenage brain is different from the adult brain. That would suggest they're less perfectly rational than we are, which probably isn't news to us. But right, so over the life course, there could be these predictable evolutions.
It's a curveball and a request. And since it is the last word, the request is, since you've been taunting us with it all evening, if you have time to share the Nancy Reagan clip, it would be fantastic.
Oh, sure.
The curveball, which has nothing to do with addiction, but every element of this question has actually come up in your talk, because you've talked about the fad and the bandwagon and the snob effect, and you've talked about the pre-commitment, which is the present self taking an action today that is very costly for the future self to reverse. Okay, my question about a fad, which is very difficult to reverse, I'd be very curious for your economic analysis of the current tattooing phenomenon.
I'd have to think about that one. Well, clearly there's got to be bandwagon effects, right? You're definitely locking yourself in. I would guess it gets back to, youth being less aware of future consequences. And so I'm guessing youths do it as a bandwagon. And what makes it, I would guess that what makes it cool is the fact that it's permanent. And so it's like smoking. It's like being, it's showing you're a badass. Like, I don't care. Like, I remember meeting a girl who'd pierced her nipples. And when I pointed out that she couldn't breastfeed then, that this would impair breastfeeding, she that was the whole point, is to prove that she was tough and didn't ever care. She didn't have a maternal bone in her body, and she didn't care a whit that she just foreclosed future self from breastfeeding, or made it harder for future self to breastfeed. And so I would, like, that's why I would imagine that the permanent tattoos are much more popular than the lick-on tattoos, or you get the same effect, but the fact that it comes off makes it lame because it's not demonstrating your disregard for future self or society. So yeah, it kind of raises the question of whether disfiguring things can we come up with that people will line up to get from us, to signal how tough they are, right? Like branding in the U.S. among African-American fraternities is big, completely irreversible. where you get branded with the letters of the fraternity. Hurts like hell, serves no practical purpose, but it's a very credible commitment to the group, right? That's hard to reverse. So. One more before Nancy Reagan. So the Nancy Reagan clip. So the idea there, the idea behind this is that when I was a kid, Nancy Reagan was the first lady, and her cause was getting people off of drugs, right? So Michelle Obama's actually is to help people lose weight and avoid childhood obesity, and Nancy Reagan's was to help people get off drugs. And what was really fascinating is that the campaign actually acted as if drug users were perfectly rational. Right? So the interesting thing is that they really seem to believe that all you had to do was tell people not to be on drugs and they'd stop. And so this is a perfect illustration of this. So this is a commercial that ran a lot of Nancy Reagan, and I have not edited it in any way. You will see it in its entirety. Oh, wait, I actually have to run it on Windows.
Hello.
Oops.
This is Nancy Reagan. If you just say no to drugs, you'll be saying yes to a whole lot more.
That's literally the commercial. So anyway, you'd think instead of providing information about risks or, you know, looking for ways to talk about stigma or health harms, but no, it's just literally, you know, there's consequences. Good luck. You know. So thanks very much for coming. I really appreciate it.